This episode is brought to you by Madcore Festival. Probably Madrid's biggest and best festival, Madcore is returning once again this summer and it's going to be one to remember. Not only will there be massive names like Dua Lipa, Janelle Monáe, Bring Me the Horizon and The Killers playing, because who doesn't love a bit of Mr. Brightside after a day of pints in the sun? There'll also be tons of new buzzy acts like Nia Archives, Crawlers, Kneecap and Picture Parlour scattered across the bill too. Obviously, with it being in Madrid, there'll be plenty of ace Spanish artists to check out across the weekend. Plus, heading to a festival like this is the perfect chance to get a good dose of sunshine and culture, all while getting to watch some of your favourite bands and necking a cheeky sangria or two. This year's Madcore Festival takes place from the 10th to the 13th of July in Madrid, and tickets can be purchased now over at their website, madcorefestival.es. Hello and welcome to the newest episode of Before They Knew Better, the podcast from DIY Magazine. My name is Lisa Wright. Here is my co-host and producer. His name is Giles Bidder.
Hello.
Today we have the indomitable pop force that is Lauren Mabry on the podcast. You will probably know her as the front woman of Churches, massive band, been around in the sort of top echelons of the indie sphere for a good decade now, but recently Lauren has also been branching out and putting out her first solo work. It is a bit of a pop departure, I would say. Like, it's going through some sassy moments. It is tackling her experiences within the industry of, like, the sort of pigeonholing that she feels that she's been part of, and she's doing all of it with some absolutely solid gold bangers. So if you haven't listened to Lauren Mabry's solo work outside of Churches, go and do that immediately. But before you go and do that, now, as with all weeks on this podcast, we asked Lauren Mabry to bring in a song, a photo and an object from her youth. Now, Lauren's ones were particularly enjoyable to me because they represent the exact trajectory from a Spice Girls loving pop youth into the sort of person that would have a Block Party Silent Alarm poster on their wall, as she did as a teen. And in between that, Lauren really unlocked some sort of core noughties memories of learning how to use computers, of many of her early bands, of the sort of hateful early days of certain social media apps, although I'm going to say still less hateful than they are now. But either way, it was a proper time capsule back into the late 90s, mainly early noughties, youth of her and my previous years. Lauren's most recent single, Change Shapes, is out now. She is going to be playing The Great Escape, amongst some other commitments over the summer. And if you want more intel on Lauren Mabry's solo stuff, then dig back into the October 2023 issue of DIY, where she graced our cover and gave us a pretty exclusive at that time interview into everything that she's got coming. But for now, stay tuned and listen to the newest episode of Before They Knew Better with DIY Magazine and Lauren Mabry.
I remember having a Tamagotchi and being, like, distraught with grief when it died because I couldn't find it. And in hindsight, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. That's the adult that I then became. I can't be trusted with these things. Like, there are certain films or TV shows I'm not sure I can handle watching, and I'll get my partner to watch them and then tell me. And sometimes you'll be like, absolutely not. No. Like, I've hovered over The Father, Anthony Hopkins film, so many times. Oh, I don't know. I don't know you well enough to say if you should or shouldn't, but based on his, I was like, describe it to me. And then he went through the plot and I was like, oh, no, I'm not doing that. I won't
because
recover
from it. Because it also has small electronic pets that are being looked after.
It has the ultimate end point of the Tamagotchi. It's about Alzheimer's and death and existential things. So, yeah, if I can't handle a Tamagotchi, I definitely can.
These were the lessons, though, that I think, like, they were meant to teach you how to, like, care for, you know, like, instead of getting a, like, the pre-stage of getting a pet was getting a Tamagotchi. It was like, did you ever do that thing where you used to have a flower baby? that was meant to, and you were meant Ooh. To, did that never happen in Scotland? I feel like maybe this was even, because I don't remember whether I actually did it or not, but I definitely.
Oh, like the bag of flour.
Yeah, you
right,
had
right.
a bag of flour and you were meant to sort of look after it for a week. And like you weren't meant to, you know, you had to have the flour bag with you all the time. And it was meant to be an exercise. And like, this is what parenting is. Like, you can't put it down. You can't just leave it on the bus. You've got to like have your flour baby and keep it.
That's a powerful prophylactic. I think they were probably just worried we were going to have actual teen babies. Yeah. So they were like, don't mess around with the flour. We don't have time. We've just got to get the information to them.
We've just got to get straight to the banana lesson where you put the yes.
Well, technically, we did get sex ed, but I think they split us up into two groups so that, and this makes a lot of sense given my experiences with men when I was in my 20s. They don't teach boys about periods. Which I think is interesting. The girls get taken one way and taught about periods, and the boys get taken another way and taught about boners or whatever, I suppose. But I think it's beneficial for both groups to know about these things.
Yes.
Everybody should be taught everything, and then we would know.
Yes.
But yeah, I think I've mostly just blocked it out. And I think, yeah, we learned about condoms, and that was kind of it. You learn about condoms and ovaries.
Condoms and ovaries, sort of. And then you get the policeman to come in and say, don't do drugs. And that's, and then you get
and they didn't,
into
they didn't
the
bother
world.
With that with us. They were like, they're going to do it. They're
just
gonna
let them live their
this
lives.
Is, this is central Scotland. They've probably already done it. Like,
So we are setting ourselves in Stirling.
Yes, kind of countrysidey bit outside of Stirling. So you can see. The Wallace Monument is there. We can picture it in our mind's eye.
Nice. Okay. What sort of... So if you were slightly out of the city, did that mean that you had quite a sort of rural, you know, idyllic playing in the outside kind of childhood? Or what was your area like?
Yes. So it's technically a place called Thornhill, which is like kind of out towards Callander, the Trossachs, that kind of stuff. So yes, a lot of... Sounds very sad. A lot of time spent alone outside or in a bedroom.
Yes.
But it's fine. I have a rich interior life now.
From yeah, and boredom's powerful.
Yeah. I did a lot of activities that I just got to make activities.
Yeah.
Got to make something to do.
This seems to be like the biggest thread of everyone that we've spoken to on this podcast seems to be like the sort of less stimulating the area that you're in, the more that you're kind of forced to just create your own fun. And like, actually, I mean, I don't know, like you look at a band like Manic Street Preachers or someone like that, who like have made such a, like they sort of embraced being from this tiny town so much. And like, that was something to rebel against and to kick against. And like, I think, yeah, like you say, Giles, that sometimes boredom and having to sort of be creative with stuff rather than just having London on your doorstep is like a really powerful tool to sort of kick you up the arse into doing things.
And I do think it's been really useful for the kind of lifestyle that I ended up living. Like my mum used to say when we were kids, if I was like, I'm bored, she would be like, only the boring are bored. So you can shame somebody into doing something. But I think that, you know, now wherever we are, whether it's like a random, you're in a green room somewhere, or you're in an airport, or you're in a hotel, or you're in like an airport hotel for days on end. Like any hotel room can be my personal cinema, writing studio, spa. Like I'm like, I always find something to do, which I think is a good skill.
Nice. So, what were the things that you were doing in your spare time when you were? Let's go back to like a preteen, early days. Proper childhood time, like, did you have sort of very distinct hobbies even as a little one?
There was a lot of like playing in a garden, a lot of doing that, and I have an older sister, so we were like 3 years apart, so for that time period I think that was very good, because it's that era where your older sibling is young enough to still like you or want to have you around, and then there's a time period where they just want you to just fuck off so much. And I'm like, wait, I feel like that was a lot of
when did that kick in?
The late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah, like when I was around like maybe like 9 or 10, I think she was like, get this idiot out of my face.
I am done.
Which I think is fair, because she's, you're in a different age, you're a different stage of your growing upness at that time. And I was like, but Sarah, we have to go outside and play Invisible Horses. And she was like, I will not. I would not bring myself to play Invisible Horses with you. And I'm like, literally, it is a game that we made up where there are, you imagine that there are invisible horses.
Okay.
And you tend to them.
Okay. Nice. But would you be right? Like, you would ride the horses? You would
sometimes. Okay. Sometimes. When I look back on it again, it makes sense. My sister was very athletic and very good at those things. She would tend to ride the invisible horses. I would tend to like brush them. Just brush them.
I love that even in your deepest fantasy, you were still like, no, I'm not sporty enough to ride the invisible horse. Let her do it.
Sometimes, and I would ask her to be like the riding teacher that would teach me if I did ride on my invisible horse, and then I would just like brush the invisible horse next to the trees and stuff. I don't
That's
know.
Nice.
It was, as you say, you're like, there's limitless possibilities, and I'm like, no, I think I'll just tidy.
Yeah, I will.
Did you look up to your older sis?
Yeah, she was like, I'm sure that she would be cringed if I said this, but I was, yeah. I just, at that time, I was like, she's so cool and she's so smart and she's so good at invisible horses. Like, I can't even imagine. And even like,
how can you compete?
How can I compete with that? And like, so I've sometimes like my parents, my dad was very good at tennis, so he tried to get us into tennis, and my sister is very athletic, so she was good at the tennis. Mm. And I think I kind of, maybe I'd suppress this memory, or I don't know. We were talking about it however long ago, and my parents were like, yeah, you always just kind of wanted to go around and pick up the tennis balls and put them back into the little machine. We were like, stand there, learn, get ready, do the thing. And I was like, no, I'll just organize.
I'll just,
and I'm like, that's not very fun. I don't know why. I thought it was quite satisfying to put them back in the machine. I could have been learning a skill that would be useful for me now, but
I
don't know.
That is a skill.
You learned the skill of being tidy. Yeah. I mean, that's something.
I'm good at emails now. Is that the adult equivalent? I don't know. I think probably as a kid, like when I looked at my sibling or people who were good at sports, I was like, oh, they get praise for doing that.
Mm.
So I think I wanted the praise, but without any of the sweat or the effort. Maybe.
Is that where learning instruments and being arty started to come in?
I think, I don't know. Like, I always kind of was more in my head than in my physical space, probably.
Yeah.
I don't know. So then you go into your imagination, and I always find that stuff more exciting to me. Like when my parents would do all these lovely things, like take us to do all these sports, and I would always be like, oh, I just really, that's so nice of you. I just don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. So yes, ultimately it worked out fine. Everybody ended up where they were supposed to end up.
Yes.
But to this day, I'm like, can't throw or catch anything to save my life.
That's fine, isn't it? You can catch a tune when it's being thrown at. Yes, so that's all that matters, really, isn't it? At what point did, so I mean, before we get into the things that you've brought in, one of which is a photo of you behind a drum kit, at what stage did sort of music start to enter your life in like a big way, in like a way where you were just like, this is my thing?
There was always music played in our house. I know, like, even though my parents aren't musicians, they really just loved music in a kind of top 40 chart sense. Mm-hmm. So there was always like radio on in the car and in the house, and it was a very, depending who you speak to, I think, good era of British pop bands.
Yes.
So being that age and having Top of the Pops and Smash Hits and those things, I'm like, yeah, you're a little girl in the UK at that time, that was the best. It was the best thing
so
ever.
Good.
Like, to, I like, especially when you live in the middle of nowhere and you don't have many friends to talk to because of geographical location, the idea that of the Spice Girls or All Saints or any of those bands were very exciting to me, because I'm like, ah, there's a group of girls and they're all friends and they're dancing and they're singing and they're singing about friendship. It's so exciting. So yeah, I feel like that's the first time I felt really connected to it. And I would watch Top of the Pops pretty religiously.
Yeah.
And sometimes I would listen to the chart on a Sunday to find out who got number one, to imagine who might be on the show on Friday.
Nice.
So yes, I was pretty dedicated Top of the Pops fan, RIP.
Do you remember, I think it was in either Top of the Pops or Smash Hits magazine, they used to have those like pull out cards in the middle that had all the song lyrics and stuff on them?
Oh yes. And the stickers.
Yeah,
I loved the stickers. I avidly collected the stickers, and I remember having one, a big a big, big Spice Girls one that was like half a page and it had everybody in it. And having the sticker book at school, everybody was always trying to trade for the Spice Girls one. And I was like, no, absolutely not. No amount of Boyzone stickers can amount to this. I'm sorry. Sorry to them. But I never had any of like the puffy pop-up stickers.
Oh my God.
Those always seemed really cool to me.
Yes.
But I didn't have any of those. So I definitely gave away a couple of Ronan Keatings to get like a fuzzy sheep one or whatever. But sorry, Ronan would understand. He's a man of the world.
Exactly. He's an animal lover. Yeah. Does that mean that, I mean, if you were an avid reader of like pop magazines and stuff when you were younger, does that mean like when you first started to be in magazines and that had like a real significance for you?
Well, I guess I'd wanted to work in, like when we first were starting Churches, I was kind of doing some freelance writing stuff, but I was like a production assistant, personal assistant for film and TV stuff. So I think I always like wanted to be part of making things to a degree. But and I remember like, you know, it was exciting when Churches got like an NME cover and things like that.
Yeah.
Like, because they mean something to you from that period of your life. I remember I don't know why I took school so seriously, probably fear and anxiety of not doing it wrong or something. But and I was pretty into the books, was pretty into them, so I was like, guys, don't talk over the books. So yeah, very very fun in that regard. But I don't know,
like, was that something that you were sort of like happy to be like that, or were you sort of aware? Because I think like there's loads of these, like, I don't know, I really hate, like, I loved the film Booksmart, but I really hate that thing of like, oh, you were studious and you like didn't enjoy the fun of school. Whereas I actually think that most of school was kind of horrible, and I'm actually quite pleased that I was somebody that just like quite liked reading and learning things. Whereas I think like there's been a lot of films recently where they try and frame it as like, if you were a bit of a nerd, then you like missed out in some way.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like, I think I found this, you never admit this at the time, but I found the learning of it all quite pleasant.
Yeah.
Quite pleasant and quite enjoyable. I was like, oh, tell me things. I didn't know that. I mean, not like terrible at maths, terrible at sciences, but like, yeah, like English, history, those kind of things. I'm like, we just sit down and we talk, we read a book and we talk about it. And so that's pretty interesting. But you don't admit that at the time.
Yeah.
You just kind of quietly get it done. But I don't know. I look back on like, maybe this is age, I look back on especially university era and I'm like, man, I wish that you had not been so stressed about getting everything done and getting good, getting it done right, and like, oh God, spending, like, this is costing me so much money, I want to do this right, oh God, oh God. And I've been like, oh, there's a whole library there, you could have just taken out some other books, it would have been quite good, you had access to all these books, you could have, should have read about some weird shit that you would never find out about. But as I said, I was just really panicked. And now I'm like, all right, that's why mature students would join the class. When you're 19, you're like, look at these guys, they're so intense and they're like talking about the joy of learning, and I'm like, oh, it's me. I have become it.
Whereas you were, yeah, metaphorically putting the tennis balls back into the tube.
Yes, I was like, guys, let's just get it done, let's just like get it done.
But while you were doing this, you were developing loves of music, playing instruments, writing songs, or did that come later? Or like, at what point did that become a big outlet for you?
I think I played piano as a kid, and then through kind of early 2000s, started getting into bands rather than purely just pop stuff. And then I guess I joined my first band when I was 15-ish. And I started playing drums because, like for higher music in the UK, in Scotland, you need two instruments for like performance stuff. And I had piano and I didn't really want to do singing, because I've been doing it in like choirs and stuff, but it was always like you're getting told off for singing the wrong part, or like I would always get made to do the high soprano stuff, and it felt like an obligation, it was a thing you had to do and then you got told off for, and it wasn't, I just didn't feel like I liked it. So I was like, I'll learn another instrument and then I can do two instruments, and that's fine. Ironic. Nice. Now that I don't really get to play any of those instruments. And everyone's like, just sing.
Well, there's a good history of drummers and singers because it's like beat stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. I do think, yeah, like the interplay between rhythm and melody when you're writing and when you're playing, it does make sense to me. Like, and I think for me it was, like, even to this day, if I look at a guitar, it doesn't make sense to my brain. Like, it feels like everything's upside down. Mm. I don't get it. Whereas, like, if I see a piano or if I see a drum kit, it feels much more intuitive to me. Yeah. Like, it's more visual. I can understand it. And I think there was something in that. If I start playing, you can get, I feel like I could get somewhere vaguely approximately like what I've heard. Whereas when I pick up a guitar, it's horrendous. It is like... murdering baby foxes. It's not good.
Well, I mean, you know what you like and you know what you don't, and that's part of the joys of growing up. So the photo that you've brought in is you behind the drums, and as much as I do want to hear about the drumming, the main thing that I loved about this photo is all of the posters on the wall behind you, which I feel like, I mean, let me get this photo up now. We have got Block Party, Circa, Silent Alarm. There's Avril Lavigne. There's a ripped out Enemy cover of Robert Smith. There's, is that Karen? No, that's not. Oh no, that's Brody Dahl, I think.
It is, yes. I should have
Hold on. Yeah, there's some Travis Barker. Yeah, I mean, like a real, like clearly you had gone out of pop world and into just like full indie land by this point.
Yes, I was an indie girl and I wanted everybody to know.
Is that in your bedroom?
It is, yes. My parents were very kind and let me do that.
That's cool.
Yeah. I'm trying to see what else is in there. There's a badly printed out from school computer, the sticker that says I'm a loser, that's an American Hi-Fi sticker. Yeah. And then around it, I've printed out these not very good live photos of American Hi-Fi. So that's
American Hi-Fi. I never listened to them. What were they like?
Flavor of the week.
Yes, and I got it on a Kerrang compilation when you could still get those.
Yeah.
There was a Kerrang, I bought a Kerrang compilation in Safeways, I think.
Hell yeah.
So, who else? Well, I think the shiny one next to Robert Smith is Jim from Jimmy Eat World.
Yeah, had nice. That one. Also had the Foo Fighters one. I think that's...
Ah, is that... Oh, it's Big Dave, of course.
Is it? I think, it's either Big Dave or Chris Shiflett. You can, I think, although you can see that tattoo, can't you? I think it is Dave.
It'll be Dave, won't it? If he's on a big poster. It's going to be
this
old.
Rabbit poster, I have no... I don't even know why, but I was like... I'm, you know, just...
I am alternative, and it's here giving, are the reasons why.
It's giving that Avril Lavigne clip about punk. It's giving very much that. I never said I was punk, but it's not punk to say you're punk.
Was Avril a big, like, did you fully buy into the Avril mythology?
Yes, I fully bought into the whole thing. And I was like, she's just like us. She's just like us, but she plays guitar and she rocks out is what I'm
she
getting
rocks
from this.
Out, man.
And I maintain that first Avril Lavigne album is pretty perfect as a pop rock record. Like the songs on that, pretty fucking good.
It's the only CD that I swapped with my sister when I bought it. I thought I wanted to like it. I gave it maybe two or three goes and then went traipsed down to my sister's room and swapped it for something.
Mm. I do, but I do feel like at the time, I remember just every boy that I went to school with or played in bands with just ripped the piss out of me all the time for liking Avril Lavigne. And then I'm like, we learn misogyny young.
Look, did you have a crew? If you were playing in bands, like those boys, and were there other people that you were, because playing in a band, you make your own little world. And
Like there were strangely quite a lot of bands in that area of rural Scotland. I don't know why, but there was like a message board for that one of the other bands started called the McLaren Bands message board, where everybody would post about their gigs, which Brilliant. Were always in someone's garage. Or the first gig I ever put on or played was at the Thornhill Village Hall, and it was called the Thornhill Show. And
pretty cool.
So there was a lot of excitable chat about that on the message board. But
actually in people's garages, though, as in like you just sort of like open up the front bit and then play out to people on the, like,
those were quite
road.
Exclusive shows, 20 max. 20
right,
people.
Right, okay. Pretty cool.
We just wanted something to do. But
yeah,
so there was, and I think, and I'm really glad for of that in a lot of ways, because it's how I learned about a lot of bands. You're just giving each other CDs or like burning CDs. And yeah, obviously we would never do that, where we'd all go buy one from the record shop and then burn it for everybody else. So you buy one copy of One by One and then you've got 10. But
nice, nice.
Yeah.
Was there like one band or artist that was like the one that sort of united everyone in that scene at the time?
I think it was around the time of Songs for the Deaf, so everyone was very much agreed that Queens of Stone Age were the best band that had ever lived. Nice. And we should all just try to be them. And I do remember seeing them in Glasgow and seeing Nick Olivieri at the McDonald's or the Burger King next to the Central Station in Glasgow. And then now I'm like, yeah, of course that's what a guy is doing on tour. He's going to eat. He's homesick. He doesn't want to be in Glasgow. He's eating Burger King to make himself feel better. But we were like, oh, there he is.
Yeah, but also it's like seeing like Jesus in Tesco's or something like that. We were just like, what? It, yeah, the mythology, I think, of, especially because it was that time, you know, pre-social media, where you didn't see people just eating their lunch on a screen in front of you every day, where to actually see like someone that was famous doing normal person stuff just felt like insane.
It was weird. And I've never, to this day, I've never gone up to somebody and spoken to them in a public place ever, but it was a good era for those things. I remember being very excited to see Barry from the Future Heads.
Yes!
In the Central Station in Glasgow, because I think maybe he had been dating a girl that was in a band in Glasgow, maybe. So he, and then I was just like, oh, it's Barry.
Oh my God.
But then, don't want to bother Barry. Barry's just trying to get his snacks from the M&S Simply Food. Just let the man live. But it was exciting to see him and be like, in my mind, not actually waving, but I thought about it.
Yeah, I feel like Barry from the Future Heads probably didn't get that many people coming up and trying to accost him in the middle of the train station. So maybe you would have just had a lovely chat.
It was peak time. It was a post
Hounds of Love
universe. So, and I maintain, I'm like, it's very hard to cover Kate Bush. I think that's pretty awesome. I think they did an excellent job. And I actively listen to that album still. I like
it's
it.
Great album. Yeah. So around that sort of like, what, like 16, 17 mm-hmm. year old time, it was like indie, rock, all of that stuff.
Yes.
Like, yes. Was there, like, who was your ultimate around then?
I suppose it was that era of like, I felt like magazines were full of like American bands for a certain amount of time, and then the switch into like the indie sleaze happened. I feel like there was the Britpop, and then there was a reaction to that where everything was very American, and then flipped back into the indie sleaze. And I think that was, it's interesting to hear people talking about that again now, because I'm like, it just happened. It wasn't that long ago. But yeah, I think my first year of uni coincided, like Freshers Week was like Arctic Monkeys' first album era.
Yes.
So that was a pretty good time. There's a lot of stuff from that time period that didn't last that well, but that was pretty good. The being in the student union to I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor was a pretty good time.
I've got such a strong memory of Arctic Monkeys' album coming out the same day as the Kooks' first album. And me just having, I mean, I think we all know who sort of won the war in that in that particular battle, but like just as like a sort of avid indie kid being like, oh, I've only got £11, so like what am I gonna do, like, and it being like a real, oh, it was like having to choose between your kids or something like that as to which one you got. And I think I might have made the wrong decision at the time, but it's okay.
Hey man, Naive was a fucking killer song.
Naive.
I'd be very, very pleased with myself if I wrote that. I
was obsessed with Seaside. I thought Seaside was a real deep cut.
And She Moves in Her Own Way, that's quite nice as well. There's a lot of nice ones on there. Weirdly, I was talking with my friend about this like a couple of weeks ago about the Kooks' first album, and then we went on an Instagram dive to find out what Luke from the Kooks was doing.
What are you doing?
I think he's still good. In the Kooks,
He's been in the Kooks. I think they did an anniversary tour. He has a baby.
Nice.
He has a band with his wife. This is what I learned. And then we were like, careful. We call it get the gloves on. To not, we're like, careful. Yes. Don't like anything you usually like. But now I'm telling you. So, but we were just like, I wonder what he's up to. And then we're like, oh, yeah. Like, they aren't frozen in time. They do. Mm. Time does pass. And I'm like, this man's got a baby. How does he have a baby? He's like 22. And I'm like, no, he's not.
Anyway. So the first band that you were in would have been around that sort of time. Does that mean that, like, pre-churches, pre-getting the synths out, that you were going down a more sort of indie sleaze route?
I think my high school band was kind of, indie rockish. And then we did a couple of years of just kind of sounding like we would just do Blondie covers in the garage or whatever.
Nice.
And then we got to university and we're like, we're serious now, so we should rebrand it to make it more serious. And then I think we just spent several years trying to merge and rip off Idlewild and At the Drive-In and make that one band. And I don't think that should be one band, but it was a good time. We had a good time doing it. And then,
do any remnants still remain on the internet of these tracks?
I think from that, the second era was called Boyfriend Girlfriend, and I think there's some of it on YouTube somewhere. But I'm proud of that. Like, yeah, when I was talking to the main guy that I did it with recently, and we were like, yeah, that third EP was pretty good. So we retired after the third EP, and we broke up the band. But I still was like, by that point, we could actually play our instruments all right, and we were like actually getting better at writing songs. It's a bit of a bummer that we gave up after that. But,
well, three EPs as a teenage band is pretty good going. I mean, there's a lot of work as teenagers.
Yeah, and I guess we were in it from, it was a good 6 or something years. So it's quite a long time. And then I joined another band that was more, the band I was in before Churches was more kind of, we termed it post-rock pop. I'm not sure. I think it just means we like certain kinds of guitar pedals, but there are pop songs. We also like Rilo Kiley and we like guitar pedals.
Did it come naturally to you to be that dedicated band member?
Yes, I'm sure that I was not very fun for people, but I've taught. Yeah, I suppose it's the putting the tennis balls in the tennis ball machine of being in a band. I don't know. Like, to me, I was always like, right, we've got to get the gig at the Village Hall because then we'll get a gig in Stirling, and once we get a gig in Stirling, then we can get a gig in Glasgow, and once we get a gig in Glasgow, we can get a gig in London, and once we get a gig in London, we'll be signed. And I think everybody else was like, yeah, okay, but...
Or we could just have a laugh.
Yeah, and I think...
And enjoy this evening.
It just, nothing would grind my teenage gears more than people not turning up to band practice. Like, there is seldom a fury I have felt like that fury. But then, to this day, I kind of feel like that. I'm like, guys, we have to learn our parts before we get to practice. I don't turn up not knowing the words to the songs. Come on now. But I think there's a balance somewhere in the middle. I think I look at it and I'm like, I was a very serious teenager. I was very serious about this. But now I get to do it as an adult. So
exactly.
Somewhere in the middle.
There we go.
But I'm sure it was annoying for them when I was like, what do you mean you don't want to practice on Saturday night because you're going to hang out at the Swings? No, we're not doing that. We can drink White Lightning at the Swings afterwards. We have to practice. Saturday is our practice day. Never, ever, ever, ever felt so low.
So, the song that you've brought in takes us back pre any of this, back to a simpler time, a pop time, a golden era of British. Yeah, I mean, you were saying before, like, I think it was a golden era of British pop music in the sort of like, when did Never Ever, so your song is Never Ever by All Saints, which I think was what, like 94, people listening, Lauren just crossed herself in the...
As one should, in honour of
Shaznay.
In the way
that we all must do. I met Shaznay last, like, 2 weeks ago.
Is she wonderful? I hope she's wonderful. I bet she is.
She was so nice. And, like, I got more sort of starstruck meeting her than, like, you know, people that have headlined massive, you know, sort of, I think anyone that comes into your life at that age, when you're like 10 or something, is always just going to be like forever ingrained in your heart in a way that, like, people that you sort of learn about when you're an adult, like, I don't think they can ever really do that.
And Shaznay was writing those songs. Shaznay was writing them. legend. To our true queen.
Yeah. And just lovely, lovely lady. Shout out, Chasney. But yes, so that was, I mean, I should probably have looked this up. What, like 97, 98, so. Something along those lines?
Late 90s, I'm going to say. But that spoken word, spoken word intro. Woo! Like, fabulous, fabulous. I mean, if Olivia Rodrigo or whoever did that now, it would pop off. It would pop off. It'd be great.
Yes. Oh my God. Make that cover happen. That would be so good. Were you like a big sort of like pop person in that time? Because I guess that would have been like post Spice Girls, but like they were the cool, you know, they were like the cooler answer. So like, you know, on one hand you had like your Stepses, yes, Club Sevens, but then All Saints were like the ones that were like the cool kids on the back of the bus.
I mean, I loved all of it. I definitely had a moment of realization that S Club 7 TV show wasn't actually a documentary. But I knew it wasn't a documentary, but I was like, oh, this is probably like a dramatized version of how they met each other.
Like Towie.
Yeah, yes. And I'm like, and they probably did meet working in a hotel in Miami and then form a band by the pool. And now I'm like, no, that's just what Simon Fuller wanted us to think. But at the time, I was like, I was a kid, I don't know. But yeah, so I loved all that stuff. But then I feel like I feel like Spice Girls and All Saints had a bit more edge to them than these things. And I remember the whole branding of All Saints was so good. It's like, they don't care that much. And I'm like, oh, how to not care? I must study how to not care. And I really,
I will study how they do not care.
How to be carefree.
And I will copy how they do not care meticulously.
But yeah, and I just, even like in the way that they did the dancing, and like I've wanted a pair of those combat trousers so much, so much. And then if I would go to like IDX in Debenhams, I would basically just be trying to find something that looked like maybe somebody from All Saints might wear it, which I don't think they would have, but that was my goal.
Nice. What was your like style in that era? Do you remember any of the things that you would buy in an attempt to sort of go with those fashions?
I feel like there was a lot of low slung jean trouser type situations, and a lot of very flammable stretchy tops. A lot of stretchy tops. Yes. And like, I remember getting a nice top for a school disco that was like a slash neck white lycra thing, which had a bright blue like Chinese dragon on it.
Oh my god, yes.
I don't, but then also it's like Christina meets All Saints if I pair it with these baggy grey combat trousers and some platform trainers,
maybe a skirt.
Oh yes,
over
the
them.
Skirt trouser era, that was interesting time. And a lot of crimping. I crimped my hair or I would crimp sections of the hair and then spray glitter on it. Because, you know, more was more. There was no...
Yeah. It's quite a sort of... In some ways, I wonder whether parents were quite happy with those things, because it was just like, I'm going to layer up my clothes. I'm just going to wear more and more clothes and put a skirt over some trousers and then put like three belts on the top.
Yes.
And then, you know, in some ways, quite a sort of conservative era of fashion in its own
Bring back way. The going out top. Where's the going out top gone? I miss her. Like, that was like my life's goal, was to find a going out top. And then I had this really caked old Rimmel green eyeshadow that I would get involved in. And then it was weird when we went to uni, there was still the quest for the going out top, but there was everything was a little bit like business casual, kind of. Like, there's a lot of pictures I look at where I'm like, why am I dressed like a kind of funky secretary? And I think it's because of like the indie stuff and Kate Nash and like all those things. Like, there was a lot of statement necklaces and pencil skirts and like ballet flats. I wouldn't do that now.
Yeah,
wouldn't do it
okay.
now, but
waistcoats.
Oh,
I think
yes.
also had quite an era.
And I used to, even in the early churches pictures, I'm like, oh, you were really enjoying those little kind of Peter Pan boots. Like, that was a strange
it was a special time, you know. Yeah, Mate, well, that's got to be due a resurgence.
It must be. And there's all certain things that, I don't know, I think when I was younger, I would feel like cringed about certain things. And I remember deleting my MySpace in abject embarrassment. And then now I kind of wish that I'd kept them, because I think I find it quite cute to, not like, you know, like, what's that John Didion thing about staying on good terms with the women that you used to be or whatever?
Like, I think previous versions of yourself. I think it's quite
cute. I wish, yeah, I still had my Bebo. So I could look through and then see, I'm like, oh man, I spent so much time really hoping that the slightly older dude that I was dating would give me his Bebo heart for the day. And he never would. He fucking never would. And I dated that guy for like 3.5 years or something. Terrible. Awful. Begging for a Bebo heart. No more.
Okay, you're going to have to go and recap Bebo for me, because I've completely like blocked that out of my memory.
I don't remember why it was different from... I guess MySpace had the blog function. Bebo was more just like the top friends part of MySpace. And you could write on each other's walls. Mm. And then I don't really know. I think once a day you could give somebody a heart. And he would always give it to, like, sometimes he would give it to other lassies. And he would give it to dudes or give it to... It was just annoying.
Did you used to do all of the, like, sort of fledgling social media? Like, so, Bebo account, MySpace. Was there any other?
I know friends who had live journal. I never live journaled. I never Tumblr'd. I did Facebook pretty actively during that time period of everyone's uploading 200 pictures from a night out type things. But in a way, I think that's
classic.
I wish that we didn't put it on the line, but I wish somebody would send me a Dropbox link to 200 photos from a night out after we'd gone out now. Because I like that you weren't thinking about what people looked like in it. Like, in all the photos I have from that time period, it's like people have got red eyes or they're a bit sweaty, or like, but that's actually capturing, it's not curated, which I think is quite nice. But I deleted my Facebook around the start of churches, so I don't have it anymore, which is a shame. But.
Have you ever seen Tom Hardy's MySpace profile?
No.
That went sort of viral for a bit. Oh, it's incredible. It's like the most amazing, exactly what you're talking about, where it's like, you know, pre-fame, those really embarrassed. It's him just like... Just, I mean, he's like got, you know, there's one where he's like topless and he's got like his hands down his pants and he's like pounding at the camera. Okay. And it's got this really overly long about me profile description where it's like, you know, actor, lover, dreamer, that sort of thing. And it's just perfection. It's just absolute, it's glorious.
Wow. I do remember like, oh, and I think in... I guess, could you do that on MySpace? I can't remember. But in Bebo, there was like sections for interests, and it would be like films, books, TV, bands. And then I would definitely list, like, I would do an exhaustive list of bands that I liked and films that I liked but kind of hadn't seen. And that, yeah, there was a lot of like, I was like, I love the Three Colors trilogy. I'm like, no, you don't. You don't. But you like the idea that somebody thinks that you've seen that.
Put your top 8 friends as bands or people from bands instead of like your actual mates.
The top 8 was so draining. I think I did do the bands thing in the end. I think once they let you make it not 8, I think I put like my band or my bandmates in it, and then I left it like that. Because it was so sad to be moved around. And again, it was that same guy with the Bebo heart. I would like look at his top 8 and I'd be like, oh, he's moved me out of his top 8. And I'm like, oh no, how tragic. That this man in his 20s has moved you out of his top 8, as he should have. He had no business being here. Get this man out. This is horrendous.
I think there's nothing more cruel. Like, in some ways, like, yeah, being ghosted, sad, but like that's like public ghosting, sort of. It was so
public.
And
I feel like it was just such an era of those social media things. Like, I think in our eventual breakup, Facebook was a big part of it. Because tagged pics on Facebook and then me being like, he hasn't replied to me in like 5 days, but he's at Stereo, with his face very close to this. And then I was like, I wish I'd been out and doing something nice with my life rather than conducting like a high-scale investigation. Mm-hmm. But I did figure it out from Facebook, so there you go.
Also, when Facebook had the It's Complicated...
yes, I also fell victim to that, where we were in a relationship and then he changed his to It's Complicated, and I was like, can I be part of this comms? Can I be part of this conversation? But then now it makes sense to why everyone's like, wonder why. Lauren from Churches writes a song to shows, and I was like, forged in the fire. Forged in the fire, guys. Like, but that's fine. I'm sure he's a... Well, no. I was going to say I'm sure he's a nice guy. I don't know. I'm sure he's fine.
Who knows?
He's probably happy.
He's not in your top eight anymore. Yes. It doesn't matter. So we move on to Mavis Beacon teaches typing. Had not thought of that, and the second that I googled it was just like,
there it is, it's in your brain.
Was that tell everyone about Mavis who might not know?
It's a computer program that teaches young people to get secretarial skills, I guess. It's supposed to help you get your typing really good and up to speed. And I will maintain to this day, I'm a pretty fast typist. But technically, I don't remember ever doing it at school, but my mum was a teacher, so she had a copy of it from the school that she worked at. And this is even sadder, she brought it home and I would play it at home as if it was a video game. Because we didn't really have video games. Like, my parents weren't super into the video games at all, so... Any video games I played were free ones that came with the computer or this one that my mum brought home from school. So I had no parallel. I didn't know what it was like playing like Batman on the Game Boy or whatever. So to me, typing really fast to keep those penguins on the ice blocks, those were some real high stakes. That was like, actually, I was like, gotta... So it would be like, yeah, the exercises are set in a kind of gamified manner. Like, Ian from Churches told me there's a game called Typing of the Dead. Which is like a zombie game which involves typing. So he was like, you'd be great at that. I'm like, huh. But that's kind of the only video games that, like, I know really from that time period. Like when my peers were playing like Goldeneye or like the start of Grand Theft Auto and things, I was like, what about Mavis Beacon is the thing? What about that, guys?
Have you tried typing 100 words a minute on Mavis? What is even a good, is 100 words a minute good?
I don't know. I haven't had to do it in a while, but I guess, yeah, when I worked in offices, like I learned shorthand writing and typing. So it was pretty useful in an office, but not useful in like a social setting when people are talking about games. And I do feel quite bad because Churches is a band that's quite associated with game culture because Ian and Martin from the band are massive gamers and we've put a lot of music in games. I feel bad whenever I hang out with people in the game sphere because I'm like, I got one for free with the computer and I have no idea what the name of it was, but it was about this little man called Adibu.
What did he get up to?
He just had a little house in the woods. And like, your job was to help Adibu clean his kitchen and tend to the vegetables. And that game, Cats, with a Z, where you just, there's a cat in a room and you just like pass it. So I feel like my parents did a good job of like, they were like, she will be very happy in life because standards are, there's no, you know what I mean? I was like, oh, wow. Like, just pet a cat in a video game for like an hour. But I do remember buying the only games that I actually ever bought to play when I was a teenager were the Harry Potter PC games.
Okay.
Which obviously I would not buy now because I do not co-sign on the contemporary J.K. Rowling universe.
At the time,
I do remember it being quite thrilling to be able to ride a broomstick through some hoops. But that's what makes it even sadder, isn't it? You're like,
yeah, I feel like, yeah, there's a lot that's been lost of childhood.
Do you think Mavis Beacon helped you play piano?
Oh,
I thought, excuse me, do you think Mavis Beacon helped you be good at the Harry Potter PC game? And I was like, no. Very different discipline. Yeah, we were like, oh, everyone hates this conversation. Let's move. I don't know. I suppose it is dexterity. I suppose you're getting contrary motion from Mavis Beacon.
Touch type. Did Mavis Beacon do touch type? Or is touch type...
What's that?
I just remember the idea of touch typing.
Where you don't look at the keyboards and you can just sort of like...
Oh.
I suppose so.
Oh, well, weirdly, I can kind of do that on my phone. People have said that that's quite weird. If I'm like talking to them, then I'll type out a text.
That is good.
But But that's the I think, yeah, it's knowledge of a QWERTY keyboard.
There we go. It all stems back. When I was Googling Mavis, there's a podcast apparently about, like, where is she? Like, the mystery of Mavis Beacon. That the woman.
Is Mavis a real person?
So I think the woman who was, like, her avatar or whatever, like, the woman on the front of the packaging was just like a model or something that they got in to stand in for it, but then everyone was trying to find who this woman was in real life. And I'll be honest, I didn't read the entirety of this article, but yeah, I think she's like a sort of mythic figure now in, like, you know, the turn of the century pop culture, part of all of our lives, but a mystery in her own.
Maybe for the best. Never meet your heroes, you know.
Never meet your heroes.
We don't need to know.
If you'd have seen her in Glasgow McDonald's going to get a burger,
like, if I saw the model, I probably would be like, ah.
Yeah. Hey-o. check out
fast as fuck. Fast as fuck. Those penguins are never falling off those icebergs. Not on my watch. No way.
Do you remember getting a computer?
Yes, I kind of. I think my mum would get. Had access to, was it, did she get a discount through work? She was a teacher or something? I don't know.
Mm.
But I remember it coming home, and I remember, like, the dial-up internet era.
Mm. Yes.
But there was an era of, like, playing with Adabu in his little house before the internet happened. And then, yeah, the era of, like, you trying to get on MSN while your parents are on the phone. They're like, stop it.
Yeah. Mm.
But RIP MSN. I remember being actively very worried, like perplexed by what... This idea that I was like, what will I do when I'm married and I have a husband and we both want to be on MSN at the same time? And now I'm like, ah, we have computers in our pockets. MSN does not exist and I do not have a husband. There are many layers to this that did not come to pass.
And that feels like a good place maybe to wind this up, as all of the illusions of childhood, in some ways, life is... more complicated. In some ways, you don't have to worry about these awful dilemmas of MSN sharing and people being on the phone. And yeah, do you think, I mean, a thing that we've started sort of asking people at the end is like, which bit of your, like, what in your current life do you think the childhood version of yourself who we see in these photos and who we're talking about would be the most excited about having come to pass?
I don't know. I think I always had a sense that I would be a better adult than I was a kid, kind of. And I think, yeah, it's probably true. And I'm like, yeah, I get to live in my own house. I've got two real cats that are not computer-based that hang out with me. I have a nice partner who is not my husband, but by choice. And, you know, Bebo doesn't exist, but he would definitely give me his Bebo heart and he wouldn't make me beg for it. So I was like, oh, that's good. Loads of things worked out. And I was like, yeah, there's like a nice indie boy that I'm metaphorically in his top eight. And I think that's pretty good.
That's nice. Yeah. That's good. There we go. Victory, and screw that guy and all of his Bebo hearts.
Life gets better. Life's supposed to get better.
You know? It's going to be all right, guys. The things that you think are really world-ending, turns out you'll be fine.
That was Lauren Mabry of Both Churches and her own increasing solo fame. All of us can agree that Lauren is great and we want to be her best friend. Thank you to Lauren for joining us. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, why not dig back into the last series and a half of Before They Knew Better? It has got people from across we're up to 16 episodes now, about 16, 17, something like that. And amongst those episodes, you can find chats with C-Matt, with The Cribs, with Kat Burns, going back into series one. We've got Killer Mike and Remy Wolf and literally loads of people. Give us a like and a subscribe and you'll get all of the forthcoming episodes of the podcast into your inbox on a Tuesday morning. And while you're at it, why not check out the newest issue of DIY Magazine? It is our special festival guide issue and it has an exclusive first chat with the wonderful Softplay ahead of the release of their forthcoming comeback album, Heavy Jelly. It is heavy, bangers-wise, but it is also very fun and full of the sort of lovable humour that only Softplay can do. That is out now, and it also has a bumper guide to everything coming up over the summer across the fields of the UK and beyond. Go and check that out. Get it from diymag.com/shop. Order it online. Give us a like and a subscribe, and we will see you next week for the next episode of Before They Knew Better with DIY Magazine. This episode is brought to you by Rock in Rio Lisboa. The sister event to Brazil's iconic music festival Rock in Rio, the Portuguese leg of the event is set to celebrate its 20th anniversary with one of its biggest editions yet, and over 80,000 attendees across its 4 days, of which some of them could be you. Taking place over 2 weekends this June, some of music's biggest names will be taking to the stage in Lisbon. We're talking Ed Sheeran, we're talking Doja Cat, even the Jonas Brothers are getting in on the action. And with each day specially curated by genre, there's literally something for everyone. I went to The Town in Rio last year, which is curated by the same people as Rock in Rio, and it was, I'm going to say, one of the wildest festivals I've ever been to. This year's Rock in Rio Lisboa takes place on the 15th, 16th, 21st and 22nd of June, and tickets can be purchased now via their website, rockinriolisboa.pt.